exploring what revelation meant to the people who heard it.
Right. We're going through Revelation. We are reading through Revelation and attempting to place ourselves back where the original audience would have been. And we're trying to understand what they would have heard and what they would have understood.
And the trumpets. Oh, let's see, I have the last one in here.
So there's been a series of sevens, you know, the seven churches, the seven seals,
the letters, yeah.
And now the seven trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
The seven churches discussed what the problems that the churches on earth were experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
The seven seals took the perspective up to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And it described the response that heaven was giving to what was happening on earth. And now the seven trumpets is actually an expansion of the seventh seal.
Mm-hmm.
Seventh seal, kind of, instead of being its own isolated unit, it expands the scene into the seven trumpets. And we've been taking the book of Revelation as a dramatic form. There's evidence that when John wrote down what he had seen, he wrote it in a form of a form patterned after Greek drama.
Mm-hmm. So it was meant to be a verbal dramatic.
It was meant to be read. It was meant to be heard.
Uh-huh.
It was meant to be, the scenes were meant to be imagined.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, the key thing about the seven seal was, or the seals, were that these seven seals were holding closed the scroll that was given from God to the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is curious about what is in the scroll.
Uh-huh.
Well, the seven seal is opened, but the scroll itself is not yet opened. So we don't yet know for sure what's in the scroll. Instead of the scroll being opened, the trumpets sound. And these trumpets, this whole scene now is alluding back to the Hebrew sanctuary service.
Mm-hmm.
This is the morning sacrifice, where the ashes from the previous day are cleaned up, new coal is placed onto the altar of incense. And at the same time that all of this is going on, the trumpets sound. There's mm-hmm. silence. So the temple choir is singing, and for a brief moment, there's silence as the trumpets are sounded. And this is the allusion John is making for this series of seven trumpets. What we see here is an allusion back to the story of Exodus. There are a number of plagues that have parallels to the plagues that fell on Egypt during the Exodus. And one of the frameworks throughout the Bible is the Israelite Exodus is a pivotal moment in Israelite history. It's what defines them.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever prophets write about judgment and deliverance, they frequently go back to the Exodus story as the place where they find images and metaphors. John is doing the same thing. In fact, the whole history of salvation can be symbolized as a new type of Exodus. It's a deliverance. It's a deliverance story. It's a story that provides freedom and liberty. The Exodus does the same thing, from physical bondage to the powers of Egypt. The story of the cross is a Exodus from bondage and captivity to sin. Now, what Revelation is picturing is the church is now being held captive, or it is in danger of being, of going into captivity to Rome, the powers of Rome, pagan Rome. And John is picturing a type of exodus from this power, the pagan powers. An important thing to note as we read through these plagues, the judgments that come through these, the sounding of these trumpets, is that these events unleashed are falling upon only upon those who choose to reject God. We've already established back in the seven seals that those who are sealed, in other words, those who have chosen to belong to God, they have nothing to fear. Egypt had 10 plagues. There's no one-to-one correspondence here. Mm-hmm. John is simply pulling some of the imagery, the metaphors, the plagues.
Especially in the first four trumpets, you see a lot of plague-like imagery. And then...
So the first four trumpets, you know, they're just very quick, right? One after the other. The fifth trumpet is long, and that was, you know, we talked about that the last time. Some of the things that we concluded is that what the fifth trumpet appears to be describing is some kind of a counterfeit power to the power of Christ, to the power of the Lamb. But the way John describes it is that even though it is quite powerful, in the end, it is inferior to the power that is wielded by Jesus, by the Lamb. Mm-hmm. One of the things is that this power that's described in the fifth trumpet does not have the power to kill. Only God has the ultimate power to determine life or death.
In verse 5, that power to torment, but you can't kill him for 5 months. But in verse 4, it says that's only to those who have not received the seal of the forehead.
Correct.
So he's not tormenting those who are sealed in the forehead, he's tormenting the ones that are not sealed.
Yes.
Okay.
The conclusion that we sort of came to there is that this false power tempts and attracts people. But in the end, it's a trap because this false power is unable to deliver on all of its promises. In fact, what happens is that this false power ends up tormenting the very ones who choose to accept it.
The false power.
Okay. It hasn't been really described yet.
Is that kind of like yourself?
Well, what we'll see as we go on in Revelation is that this false power clearly points to pagan Rome. It is an indictment of the power.
Human versus God.
Was not politically correct.
No. No, it would not have been politically correct. It's an accusation against Rome.
In other words, it's a political book.
Well, in that day, politics and religion, was it one thing?
They were one thing.
Obviously, if your ruler of Rome is a self-proclaimed demigod, you should not fall under the
worshipping somebody else. Worshipping somebody else as supreme and declaring that the emperor isn't so great.
Well, I think we talked about this before. It's relatively a recent phenomenon that we think about politics in one sphere and we think about religion in another sphere. That's not a very historic concept, is it?
That is a very modern concept. It's part of the... Really, it's part of the revolutions that took place, the American Revolution, the French Revolution. It's all in that modernist era.
It's not only just modern, it's local to our experience. Mm-hmm. Because you have to say that we still have to go into doesn't happen in there.
Right.
In
And because we have it in our psyche, you might say, we think that's the only way, that it's the right way. Who knows what's right or wrong, but it's what it is.
Quite a lot of the globe still, if you are part of the country, you must worship the way
you're supposed to. How can you be part of the way if you don't think that?
Just talking about it.
Right. Well, it's more of a fantasy that our religion and politics are separated nowadays than it is a truth, because we can't even elect a president unless they're quote unquote Christian or what. So, I mean, not
that sounds like a political statement.
What I'm saying is that the fantasy that we have of separation in this day and age is more of a fantasy, because almost the majority of the countries are ruled by some sort of, biased religious group.
The truth is, we are pursuing it. In the past, we had two different degrees. We have achieved separation of church and state. We perceive that that is good, if that's really good enough.
So, let's see if there's anything else. So, trumpets symbolize a call upon God. Trumpets were sounded by the Israelites to call upon God. When they went out to war, trumpets were used to call upon God to bring justice. We've noticed the repetition of a third throughout these trumpets, indicating that even though the events that are unfolding through the sounding of the trumpets are horrific, it appears that God is still restraining the full extent, the full consequences of these events. Imagery, numbers, and times are symbolic, or maybe perhaps better, they're metaphoric. They don't necessarily have a historical correspondence. They may not. We've noted that the seven trumpets probably began with the ascension of Jesus, and they will end with his taking possession of the earth, based upon the language that's found at the very beginning and at the very end of this series of trumpets.
The first trumpet started with the ascension of Jesus?
Yes. When Jesus entered when Jesus began his ministry in heaven. And at the very end, at the seventh trumpet, it basically reads that that ends when Jesus takes possession of the earth again. We talked about affecting who it affects, and we talked about the Exodus from Egypt, the pattern there. So the church is the new Israel. That's one of the things that John repeats over and over in Revelation, is when the Old Testament prophecies that apply to Israel, the messages that apply to Israel, is now applying to the church. The church is Israel. And deliverance from oppression, and the pattern of Exodus is deliverance from oppression, and it reveals God's power. The oppression that John's immediate audience would have been experiencing is not necessarily persecution. There was no empire-mandated persecution of Christians at this time. It may have happened in isolated locations for short periods of time, but it's not necessarily an empire-wide persecution. But emperor worship was very important. Mm-hmm. We've already discussed back in the seals that one of the things that the Christians would have faced is that they would have not have been able to participate in trade guilds at the time. Because part of the trade guilds was to sacrifice and to worship not just the emperor, but various deities, their patron deities. And so they would have had difficulties in business. They would have had faced the pressure to conform to those practices in order to make their livelihood. So that is the primary oppression that John has in mind as he is writing Revelation. It's not explicit pressure, but it's the implicit pressure of having to conform to the pagan model of things in order to secure their physical lives here on earth. And so we talked about the fifth trumpet, and it describes what happens to people who rely upon those worldly systems. John's vision, what he recorded, was basically the world bites back. If you seek your security in the systems of the world, it will bite you back. It will abuse and harm those who seek to rely on those things for your security. So it's in that kind of broader context that we read the next several verses in chapter 9, Revelation chapter 9, 12 through 21. The sixth trumpet. The first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come. Then the sixth angel blew his trumpet, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, "Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour, the day, the month, and the year were released to kill a third of mankind. The number of mounted troops was twice 10,000 times 10,000. I heard their number. And this is how I saw the horses in my vision and those who rode them. They wore breastplates the color of fire and of sapphire and of sulfur, and the heads of the horses were like lions' heads, and fire and smoke and sulfur came out of their mouths. By these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed by the fire and smoke and sulfur coming out of their mouths. For the power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents with heads, and by means of them they wound. The rest of mankind, who were not killed by these plagues, did not repent of their works of their hands, nor give up worshipping demons and idols of gold and silver and bronze and stone and wood, which cannot see or hear or walk. Nor did they repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts.
Okay.
Interesting. So,
there's some literary connections between this trumpet and the previous one. In the fifth one, there was a swarm of creatures that were sent out to destroy. There appears to be another kind of a swarm of things that goes out to destroy. There's some similarities in the attributes of this members of the swarm. There's likeness of horses, lions, mouth and tails being used as weapons. There's fire and there's smoke. Euphrates. Where is the Euphrates?
In Egypt.
No.
Where is the Euphrates? Is it next?
Yeah, it's it's Babylon, Persia. It's one of the big rivers.
It supplies food.
It's just one of the major landmarks of the ancient world.
It would have been north of Jerusalem quite a ways up as the
It would have been east.
You could have gone north and find it. The big down is east. It's right here.
Oh, it flows that way. It flows southwest.
It flows into the Persian Gulf, yeah.
Or it doesn't flow into the Mediterranean.
No.
Okay, that's right. And the Tigris. When the Tigris and Euphrates join, which one is to continue that?
Euphrates.
And the Nile, it flows into the Mediterranean. It's
correct.
On the other side, it's pretty bad. Okay. But there are three rivers.
Okay, there's a mention of a golden altar. This is in reference back to the altar of incense that we saw immediately preceding the scene of the trumpets. It's where the prayers are offered and they are rising as smoke. This trumpet mentions four angels. Are these the same as the ones told to wait? Are they the ones that are holding back things between the sixth and seventh seals? Or are they different four angels? We again see the term third, a third. Now, previously, this was, as mentioned, symbolic of God's forbearance and mercy. John hears a number, 2 × 10,000 × 10,000, so a fairly large number. He also sees something else. This again fits the pattern that we've noticed in Revelation, is that John hears something and then sees something that is not quite the same. So, something to note here is that this is similar in concept to the numbering of the sealed 144,000 and the great multitude. John heard the number 144,000 and then he saw the great multitude. Same thing happening here. This number also echoes the number of angels that were recorded in chapter 5, verse 11. In 5:11, it was reported myriads and myriads and thousands of thousands. 10,000 is apparently the largest Roman number. And so 10,000 times 10,000 would be essentially considered unnumberable, and double that.
It's 200,000, that's what my Bible says. 200,000.
But I don't know if that's what it really means. It means a really large number, larger than.
Yeah, see, that's where,
and then double it.
That's where some of the, you know, the translations that translate this in English terms fails to communicate the metaphor that's being.
In other words, in that culture, we're not talking about precise. We're not talking about numerical accuracy.
It's not about precision. It's about the
whole.
It's a huge number.
So it goes along with the dramatics.
Yeah, it's a dramatic
scene where
a dramatic
the unimaginable is happening.
I heard a voice. The speaker is not identified. Again, common to what we've already seen in Revelation, similar to chapter 1, verse 10. There's a voice like a trumpet. And in chapter 6, verse 6, in the third seal, there's a voice that is heard.
In 15, the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour. Does that mean they were sitting on the sidelines for a year, a month, and a day, and an hour? Or does that mean that they were let loose for a year, a month?
No. So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour, the day, the month, and the year.
Oh, as in, they were prepared for this particular moment.
So this is a moment in time, not a. You don't add a.
It's not a period of time, but rather a
moment.
This particular year, this particular hour.
What John is saying.
This particular day.
Yeah.
Have you heard this as a pop song? I can't remember the words exactly, but no. It's been 2 days, 2 months, and a year, and 2 years since you went away, or whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's the same sort of emphasis. When we switch it around, we all sit up. You know,
might
as well do that, but I've been married for 3 days, 4 months, and 15 years. You scratch your head, but you say, what are you trying to say? It must have been something that he cares, you know.
Interesting.
Okay, but it's a point in time. This is.
In other words, the four angels are.
They're not allowed to do their work until some point in time.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense.
And these angels are released to do the work of destruction and to kill, but the actual slaughter, as this trumpet imagery shows, is it's done by this 2 times 10K by 10K, this 200,000, this large horde, 10,000, to a million, some,
280. You already talked about this, the relationship between the four angels and the 200 million?
That's where we're at.
That's where we're going right now.
It's just, an observation is that although the four angels are the ones commissioned to kill, they're the ones that actually do the slaughtering is this great horde.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, as part of the initial observation is that only a third are affected. Only a third of those who have rejected Christ, rejected God, are affected. So there are still two-thirds of the so-called not part of God's family that are spared. But what this, in the verses 20 and 21, describe is that those who are spared do not repent. There are three categories of evil that they do not repent from: works of their hands, false worship, and wrong actions.
So what's the relationship between four angels and a lot of an infinite number times two?
Well, I don't know.
They just they're kind of like representatives of this mob.
There's four different false religions and then the millions that follow them?
Well,
what is the four? Where do we see four elsewhere?
Four angels.
The other place that we saw four angels was in angels at the four corners of the earth. And so for us, there may be some question as to whether those four angels are the same as these four angels. And I think we will kind of get to that in a little bit here. A little bit of background information. Parthians were Rome's most feared enemies in this period. We've talked about them before. They were portrayed as untrustworthy, and the authority of their monarchs was absolute. Older Greek prophecies about an eastern invasion of the Roman Empire still made some Romans nervous, and the Jewish Sibylline oracles prophesied that Nero would return, leading Parthian hordes and vengeance on Rome. Parthians were mounted archers who could fire backwards.
Can you trust the Parthians?
Who are Parthians? They're kind of a Persian Greek.
Well, Persia's way down there. Was it Greek in here?
So they're racing their horses after them, and then it's shot from the front, from the rear of them.
Yeah, that was, the Parthians were one of the illusions in the fifth trumpet as well.
Persian.
Their tails, like scorpion's tails, stinging, being used as weapons, they were able to fire backwards while mounted and riding.
Because they'd invented stirrups.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear about Parthians at the Golden Dome? Parthians? It says the Jews settled in Parthia in the time of Acts. You can see that. The Parthian Empire stretched from India to the Tigris and from the Urum Desert to the Southern Ocean. So this is Arsaces, 256 BC, revolted from the Seleucid successors of Alexander the Great and founded it.
So I was going to ask, was it before or after the
massacre? So this is after Alexander the Great, so the Greek connection.
There's a Greek-Persian...
Greek Empire, at one point under Alexander the Great,
right.
Encompassed,
right.
That was split up the four different generals got their portions, and then the Seleucid power, this is a break-off from that, they revoked from the Seleucid succession to form the Parthian Empire.
Okay.
Cool. This is from Tossin's passage.
Uh-huh.
Is the Parthian?
Parthians?
No, is it Parthian?
Parthenon?
Is that
the Parthenon is something
different.
Well, what's that big temple that's still Parthenon?
Parthenon.
Okay.
Well,
isn't that in Greece, and that's unrelated to this temple?
It's unrelated. Another piece of background. Ancient literature indicates that it was common knowledge that the river Euphrates was, above all else, the traditional boundary between the Roman and Parthian empires. Some other Jewish texts speak of fallen angels being bound in the depths of various seas, able to be released only at the command of God or one of his angels.
When was Alexander the Great and his four generals? What time did that?
Generally speaking, it's prior to 265 BC.
Okay.
It's part of what?
Yeah, I would say somewhere around 300 BC.
300 BC?
Somewhere around there.
Here,
well, relatively recent history.
Here it says 356 to 323 BC.
And somewhat after the Babylon?
So there was the Neo-Babylonian Empire, which was actually fairly small, which was taken over by the Medes and the Persians. And then the Greeks conquered the Persians. Alexander dies. It's divided into four. And there's a period of instability until the Roman Empire, as is known now, asserts its power.
And during that instability is Christ's time?
No. By that time, Rome has asserted its power.
So it's before the instability.
The Pax Romana would have been up here
yeah.
A few years before, a century or so before Christ, to a few centuries after. Is that right? For about 300 AD.
Yeah.
And the Pax Romana is simply the Roman peace.
Right.
The time in which Rome has pretty much stable control.
So, for the knowledgeable people, this is relatively recent history.
Mm-hmm. Relatively, yeah.
If they were informed and reading, it would have been like us talking about the colonial expansion and
the American Revolution.
The Napoleonic Wars, all the mm-hmm. 18th to early 19th century. Mm-hmm. Does that sound roughly
as
fresh in the mind?
Yeah.
In other words, people on the street don't wake up and think about it.
No.
The people who are educated and contemplated
about these
cases.
It would form they would know it.
Yeah.
No, it's not something at the forefront of their daily lives.
Not the enough. No, it's just more the Second World War and it's where we're still impacted by.
Like our immediate ancestors fought it.
Or
yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a little bit more about the Parthians. Parthians were noted horsemen. Mm-hmm. In contrast to Rome, where only cavalry contingents were drawn from its auxiliary units, the Parthians were renowned for their cavalry. Mm-hmm. Parthian archers often used flaming arrows. Mm-hmm. Rome feared them. It was in the psyche of the people that this was a grave threat. Again, Euphrates is a standard symbol of a boundary. It's the border of land promised to Abraham. It's in Genesis 15:18 as well as Deuteronomy 1:7. It's the border of the Babylonian Empire. It was the border of the Seleucid Empire. It's the border of the Roman Empire. So the significance of Euphrates here is it signifies some kind of a border. It's not about the river itself, but it's about the border. Mm-hmm. As we continue on now, a little more in detail, the 9:13 mentions horns. Horns in the Bible can represent God's power. Mm-hmm. Some references there. It can also represent God's mercy. And the story in 1 Kings is... Which one is that story? 1 Kings... This was after Solomon rises to power. This is when Solomon is crowned David's successor. Remember, there was a competing Adonijah, mm-hmm. who was Solomon's elder, who elder brother, who basically proclaims himself king, but through various, you might say, manipulations, David is talked into making sure that Solomon is named the official successor. And when Adonijah hears about this, he becomes afraid. And he goes to the temple and holds on to the horns of the altar as a symbol of mercy. Like he's asking for mercy. Mm-hmm. And at this time, Solomon grants mercy to Adonijah, telling him basically, oh, don't mess up. Though as the story continues on, not too long after, Adonijah
messes up
and is executed. So horns represent power and mercy. Four angels. Are these the same angels as the four angels that were told to wait? Well, there's some differences. The current angels are bound. They're not just told to wait, they're bound. And they appear to be the ones leading the destruction. Now, they're not just being told to let go of the winds that are being held back, but rather they're called to go and destroy. And another difference is that the earlier angels were at four corners, representing the entirety of the world, but now these four angels are bound at the Euphrates. They're at some kind of a specific border. The interpretation, so it could go either way, but perhaps it may be better to lean towards the interpretation that these represent some kind of demons that have been bound and are waiting to be released to wreak havoc.
The idea of an angel representing a demon is not convenient for this passage here. Mm-hmm. We think of it as a holy demon, mm-hmm. but...
Well, especially since back in the Old Testament, God kind of took credit for the good and the bad, so that the people wouldn't say, oh, there's these two competing gods, we have to worship both of them. So God kind of
In verse 15, there was the detailed specification of time, the hour, day, month, year, and we've already discussed that. It's judgment is permitted to fall only at God's appointed time, not before. The note of the verb tenses again, it can be important in interpreting. There's difference between permission and causation. In this trumpet, again, the judgments are being permitted to fall rather than God causing the judgments.
But if God has the power to hold it back, then he has the power to stop it. If he exercises the power to stop it, then he's responsible for it, and therefore it's the same as causation. Please tell me that's false thinking.
That's false thinking.
That is how people think. Mm-hmm. That's how we're mentored to think today.
Wow.
That's how our court system works today.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that.
There's a caveat to what to this. If you don't mind, I don't know how you know this, but I'm just like looking at resources that I have in front of me, so it's all real time. But I'm looking at the Lexicon to have this technology to be that way. But one commentator says that claims that without that angels never choose the New Testament unless it's specifically qualified to be an evil angel, then always a good angel. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, he's taking sort of he's looking across the spectrum of evidence, and he's charting a trajectory so that he can interpret some passages that aren't so clear. But if that was the case, would it be any problem? Is there a problem with interpreting this to be a truly divine God? You know, God of angels who are uncontrolled. Is that impossible to think of?
It's not impossible, but for me, when I look at the surrounding imagery, it feels more of a stretch.
Is there an angle that pulls back the winds?
Well, if I were to...
That's his job, and when he gets tired, our angels are tired, he goes back and gets replaced by another angel.
Prison is nice.
Well, they're all the same niceness. Because they're all the same parts. In other words, is this a literal angel? Or are we looking at symbolic?
Well, the whole thing is a dramatic.
It could it possibly be, I guess, is what I'm wondering, could it possibly be that this is a symbol that says that God has messengers of destruction in store to accomplish his purpose, and at the four winds we have these four messengers in store, and it's explained a little more plainly when he goes and talks about the 200 million who in other words, is it just a symbol that's saying that God has this destruction prepared and it's now being double checked?
Perhaps.
But see, I would go the other direction. I would say the devil, which is basically the attributes of sin, the consequences of sin, are the angels, the bad angels, and God asked the four good angels to bind them up and hold them at bay for a while, and the good angels finally let the bad angels go, and the normal consequences of sin started unfolding.
Yeah.
So you see the angels representing the
consequences, the
consequences, and also a conspiracy of Satan and his angels. But the number four is obviously symbolic for representing the entire plan, who are chomping at the bit to do what they really need.
Something like that.
Yeah, the language of binding also is echoed when the millennium is talked about.
Well, I thought we talked something back, well, goes back to Jesus' time. If somebody has the power to bind evil consequences, someone has the power to bind these angels, good, bad, or different, and who has more, they had to have more power than those angels had to bind them.
Correct.
That's where I put the four good angels as to be binding the four bad angels.
Okay. That works too.
Okay. The number 10,000, meaning myriads.
Mm-hmm.
2 times 10,000 times 10,000 is double the myriads of angels that were reported in chapter 5, verse 11. So this horde of evil is greater than not just the 144,000, but greater than the number of the holy angels that were reported earlier. The picture that John is giving here is that evil appears overwhelming. Mm-hmm. That there is no logical way that good can conquer.
Mm-hmm. Several myriads of evilness.
See, if I ask this question, we'll get maybe off track. You just said it appears to be no way that good can conquer evil.
Yeah.
And so I have to ask Eric, and maybe we'll have to take the discussion later today. Does God use evil to make man good? And
We've had that discussion.
I don't go there. I say God does not use evil to make good. But I believe that evil, God in his freedom, has to allow evil to have its natural consequences. So what he's done...
And I say he doesn't, because I phrase it differently. I say evil happens and God uses it.
Right.
He doesn't... I say that God doesn't make the evil and target it at you to make you good. I say it happens and God uses it.
Well, then I twist that one back around and say God will make good come out of even evil, because he's the only one who can make good come out of evil. But he doesn't love it. So the question is, at this point, is I would take the position that the evil that is being havoc is evil origin. And that the four angels, the good angels, were holding back the consequences of the evil habit.
The description of the troops, verses 17 through 19, there's similarities with the locust troops of the fifth trumpet. So the sixth trumpet is essentially a continuation of what began in the fifth trumpet. There's a continued use of fire and smoke in the description, again, indicative of continuation of the fifth trumpet. The worship of demons, verse 20 now, it was one of Egypt's sins, and that was mentioned in the Song of Moses in Exodus 32:17. That's one of the reasons why God allowed the plagues to come upon Egypt.
What would be defined as the worship of a demon? Worship of evil?
Worship of something that's not God?
What would John and his audience classified as demons at the time?
Probably various evil that is evil representatives that are claiming to be gods. That people are recognizing as gods.
Yeah, we need to get back into that ancient Roman as well as Jewish mindset and mythology, if you want to call it that.
A demon was a supernatural entity that was...
All unexplained phenomena were attributed to some power.
Uh-huh.
The Romans and Greeks had their pantheons of different deities, different spirits, uh-huh, demons. Jews, though they only had one God, but they attributed and ascribed different phenomena to angels and demons.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start worshiping the God of lightning, the God of thunder, is that what you're saying? Is they worship the powers of nature that they couldn't explain?
Right, and worship was done in order to either gain favor or to appease.
Mm-hmm.
And gain favor of the good deities to appease the evil powers.
You think in their day they actually thought that there was a conflict between worshiping the true God and worshiping the power of nature? I guess that's kind of what Paul was talking about on Mount of Athens or whatever it was.
The Jews were obviously monotheistic, but they weren't exactly immune from the pagan influence.
Right, like superstitious ideology of malicious efforts and actions by humans were obviously started in some demonic form. Like there was a demonic presence that conjured itself to make that person crazy and malicious in their actions toward other people. Or, there's something happening in a certain town where everybody's sick or crazy, and that was a demonic presence that can't be explained.
Or the animals all go crazy, or some weather phenomenon that we can't explain.
Sources, water.
So call it
So a good
so
way.
So rather than worshiping other gods, you call it angels or demons.
And a good way to represent the foul things that are to come from your ill-favored ways is to say that these demonic presences are upon you, are going to come in hordes after your person and being because you have done the wrong things or acted the wrong way. Or that they're alive and near you just because.
Mm-hmm. Isn't the emphasis here on the actual worshiping? In other words, I suppose that at a fundamental level, when I worship demons, I am actually choosing to try to appease evil.
Mm-hmm. Appease or gain favor.
Mm-hmm. And to gain favor from evil is almost an oxymoron.
Well,
it is, what the fifth trumpet described was people were doing exactly that.
Yes, because in all of the letters and all of the seals, his rhetoric is a continuation of, he uses words and symmetry like adultery and favor, because people in their both business and their lives are trying to work under a cloak of I agree with you, but I love God. And I will live with you, but I love God. And please don't hurt me, but I love God. And John is constantly trying to say, no, you can't get hurt by any of that stuff, and you only love God. And that's all there is to it. And so it's a rhetoric that just continues on over each seal and each page. It's continuous through the whole thing. It almost is, like you said, the first phrase and the first letter, and then everything after that is just a symbolic message of the same thing continued through the whole story. It seems to me.
Isn't this every human being naturally after the fall, in our corrupt fallen state, we actually try to gain favor from what is evil, and I think it's almost to a degree to say, maybe tell me if I'm taking it too far. But if all my righteousness is as filthy rags, if everything I do is inadequate and broken, and I try to use that action, that broken goodness, those filthy rags, to gain favor or to make appeasement, am I not following along the same train of the same line that those who are worshiping demons are doing? If I'm actually trying to use my inadequate goodness, but or peace, then I am doing the same thing they're doing. My worship is false worship.
That goes all the way back to Acts 2. If you want to take that even further, that same rhetoric goes way back to Acts, and then all the way to Stephen.
You go to up from the beginning, you see people who are worshiping demons, for real. They go out there and start things. And then the Christian denomination with the missionary spirit comes in, doesn't really understand the worldview and nuances. So they become Christians because now they're Christians, they get to be part of this society, they get more rights, more this and more that, and more potatoes. And maybe they can be elected to public office now because the chief is, and they practice their Christianity.
And you just change the actions that you're doing.
Maybe they didn't change the actions. Maybe they still are trying to appease this new God.
But are we doing the same thing when we live all the crops within the 10-mile radius of us are in a drought? And so we go on the radio and say, okay, everybody, we need to come to church. We need to pray to God because obviously He's withholding the rain from us because we haven't been going to church recently. So now we will all go to church on time and we will start praying.
On time. We will follow all the rules just right. Then God will make our crops grow.
Isn't that worshiping the demon?
And we will all pay our tithes.
But if you come to church to repent, then you're doing what John is calling us to in Revelation.
Then you're doing exactly what the guys in New Guinea are doing with their pigs.
Unless you're coming to church to repent, you are falling in the same trap. But isn't that what John is calling us to here? Is those who do not repent?
Mm-hmm.
Did I read that?
I think we're on the right deal, but I'm not sure.
Who's being affected by the events of this trumpet are those who are not part of God's family already. Those who are not sealed.
They have wrong theology. They have wrong thinking. They're broken.
And one of the things that's now happening here is God is showing signs, essentially, to these people who have rejected Him. They did not repent. It echoes, we have the echo of Pharaoh and his response to the signs and the plagues that fell on Egypt. What's said of him?
He refused to repent,
and his heart became harder and harder and harder. God reveals Himself in two ways in this context, through the gospel, through the message of Jesus, through the life of Jesus, and also through signs. Jesus did that in His own time. Jesus spoke the message. Jesus cared for people. He also worked signs. He worked miracles. But people who reject the gospel will never be convinced by the signs. And Jesus, what did Jesus say about the Jewish leaders of His time about signs? Or you ask for signs,
but they're not going to do it.
What's the point?
If I give you a sign, it won't do anything.
One sign isn't going to be enough. You'll ask for another one, another one, another one, and you will never believe.
But He did give them a sign.
He did. Just Himself.
But it wasn't a sign.
They were expecting Him to feel like that.
So what were the signs for? And at the very end of the Gospel according to John, John records that the signs were for the disciples. It's to confirm their faith.
Yeah, to confirm anybody who already believes it.
And what John's Gospel describes overall, there are seven major signs in the Gospel according to John. They themselves are judgment, because they force a decision. Now, judgment, a synonym for judgment is decision.
I'll picture this. Faith brings miracles, but miracles rarely bring faith.
True.
Yeah.
And so they do not repent. And the three sins are works of their hands. Essentially, security through self-sufficiency. I can do it myself.
Here we go.
On the other hand, servants of God, who have been described previously, they rely upon the Lamb. We cannot do anything. We will rely upon the Lamb. Second sin.
And could works of your hands, relying on yourself, go back to the trade guild, where you're appeasing and doing what you have to carry out your own works?
That's part of it.
To ensure your own security.
That would be part of it.
It's not that we can't do anything. It's that we can do everything with the Lamb. Insignificant, completely innate and unable. That's not what it is. It is that you are actually angel-like with the Lamb. God views the presence of the faithful as...
If you try to do all this stuff without the Lamb on your own, that it all becomes pointless.
Too many times and often you hear that the human entity that God made is so futile in its own being that it can't do anything. But it's just that complete opposite. The faith of the Lamb is the strongest thing that the human being has. So it's a different mentality when you think of it that way. And it's not the same as we're just all these meek things that can't subsist in life without within any ability to do anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying worship of demons, and then you're saying false worship. And then you define false worship and wrong actions. And we need to tie the worship of demons to those false actions.
Well, false worship is the second sin that is mentioned.
I'm trying to state the three.
I'm trying to state the three here. False worship is security from or security through worldly powers.
That is a worship of demons.
It is a worship of demons.
That's the key.
On the other hand, servants of God, they know in the seals in particular, in the interlude scenes surrounding it, it was shown that servants of God worship the Lamb. They are worshiping the Lamb continuously.
But you've used different words, so what you could have said is servants of God receive their security through the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than through worldly power.
Mm-hmm.
True. But I prefer the word worship because worship is an acknowledgement of what a person considers the most powerful.
So in other words, it's more important to worship than it is to achieve security. The object isn't to achieve security. The object is to worship God.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
And security comes from that.
Yeah, but my objective is to get security. I see what you're saying.
Kind of like if your goal is to get to heaven and everything is focused on getting to heaven, you might have missed the point. If your goal is to worship God and there is an eternal reward that is offered after that, then the focus isn't really what you can get.
Yeah, that's it.
Even if what you can get is the heaven and eternal reward.
He obviously knows where he's going. And that's what, for me, when I read all this stuff, the rhetoric thing just hits, because I don't tend to pick things apart too much, but I hear this guy and I'm talking to him about fishing offshore, you know, in small boats and basically being in very human situations and very grand, you know, possibilities. And he just looked at me and goes, well, what do you have to eat? You're just looking at him like, you're kidding me, right? Like, what do you mean, what do I have to lose? You know, you're thinking of all of the everything. And he's like, well, what do you have to lose? You're in a 30-foot boat, 25 to 30-foot seas, with, you know, sometimes possible 50-knot winds on it. It's an impossibility beyond what you could imagine. And he's just like, well, what do you have to lose? Kind of makes you stop and go, well, everything, but not necessarily with him, because he doesn't think there is anything to lose.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a gear up.
The third.
Healthy fear is good.
The third sin is wrong actions. And verse 21. Murders, sorceries, or their sexual immorality, or their thefts. Whether one takes them literally or symbolically, they are wrong actions. They symbolize attempts to control and abuse others for your own good, for your own security.
Oops. So the wrong actions, the work of their hands, are two different things. The one is achieving your own security. The other is controlling other people.
Other people can be threats to your security.
Yeah. If you're seeking security, if you're seeking self satisfaction, self happiness, self. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast, servants of God love one another,
mm-hmm.
and by that it is a self giving, self sacrificing. I am going to give my resources to you, so for your well being.
Mm-hmm.
And if every, you know, if we mutually do that, we will never lack.
Socialism.
Sorry. This trumpet is contrasting the systems and the attributes, the characteristics of the world. Now, what happens when humans follow worldly principles versus what God's servants look like?
The jailer was free, and John and James were in prison. But the jailer realized that John and James...
Paul and Silas.
Paul and Silas.
Thank you.
It was, he was bound and he was free,
uh-huh.
Got the jailer thinking.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, Peter was in jail once. He got out of
prison. Peter was in jail, yes. Well, there...
Yeah.
So that's...
We're supposed to listen to these guys and tell them.
So that's one of the point, the summary points that we can perhaps make from this trumpet. Second one is that in the closing periods of history, evil may appear overwhelming. It may appear greater and stronger than what God's power can handle. But appearances aren't everything. The signs, whatever they may be in our time, should reassure God's people of His power and faithfulness. But the signs are not for the people who have rejected God. It's for people who belong to Him.
To say, oh yeah, God is still there. He's on our side.
This trumpet shows that God's mercy is still extends, even to those who He knows will never accept it. Security is found only in the Lamb, through the Lamb, and from the Lamb. And finally, God's people do not need to worry about themselves. We don't need to worry about ourselves. And when we don't have to worry about ourselves, we are free to serve and to love others. So, yes, the sixth trumpet, like the fifth, contains scary imagery, horrific imagery. But if we can get past the imagery and see what John is trying to say to Christians, it is a message of hope. Not just for us, but for the whole world. Because we're the agents that are supposed to take that message of hope. Remember, Revelation was not written for people who don't believe. Revelation is written for people who believe. That's very important. Because when we preach Revelation to people who don't believe, we're preaching the wrong message.
Don't worry.